Let's talk. John Brown. The madness of courage and the exceptional achievements of Gilbert Insall. And I hope I'm saying this name right, because Group Captain Gilbert Insall holds a unique record, the only person to have won both the Victoria Cross and escaped from a German prisoner of war camp during the First World War. Now, the reason I'm saying it's part of a new book called The Madness of Courage. And the reason that I hope that I've got Group Captain Gilbert Insall's name correctly, because I'm speaking to Tony Insall, who, by the way, sounds a deduction, I imagine, is some relation. Tony, good morning to you. And first of all, do I have your surname correct?
No, you've done pretty well. Insall is, I give you 95%.
Well, that's more than I ever got in any of my mock exams. So there you go. Tony, good morning to you. Thank you for coming on the show. Tell me a little bit then about, well, first of all, this is your grandfather, your great grandfather.
It's my great uncle.
Right.
A very little background on family history. He and my grandfather and another great uncle were all born in Paris before the First World War. And my grandfather both joined the RAF, the RFC, I beg your pardon.
The Royal Army
they joined
Flying
the RFC
Corps, yeah.
in March 1915. It became the RAF on the 1st of April 1918. They'd already been interested, both of them, in flying. They'd actually, while they were living in Paris, they'd gone out to an airfield in the suburbs where the famous French aviator Louis Blériot and a couple of others, Charles and Henri Farman, were experimenting with their aircraft. And they had some flights with Maurice Farman and got very interested. They were both very good at hockey. They played hockey for the University of Paris, which might sound a bit odd in a story like the one I've been telling, but it's relevant because they played matches against a lot of the other university teams in Northern Europe before the war broke out, and they came back and enlisted in the army and then joined the RFC.
That's an interesting one, because obviously an interesting hockey, because that is, I presume, the flight of the ball and also undisguised violence at times. Hockey can be quite the physical game.
I'll try that one on some of my RAF friends and see what they say.
But it's a fascinating time, isn't it? Because obviously, I mean, flight has only just come in. As I said before, I really interrupted you, but it's the Royal Army Flying Corps, isn't it? It's not even the RAF at this point. And flight is in its infancy. I mean, it's less than sort of 20 years, isn't it, since the Wright brothers. And Blériot is the first man across the English Channel, of course, isn't he?
That's right. Yeah. Yes, he was. It was extraordinarily basic. I've actually got a picture of one of the early aircraft, a Farman, because both Farman and Blériot built their own aircrafts, which were used by the Royal Flying Corps in the first part of the war before we started building our own. I've got a photograph of one in the book, which actually shows the aircraft being pushed out by quite a lot of people, but also being towed by a horse. So it needed both horsepower and manpower to get it to the stage where it could stagger into the air. And those early aircraft were very fragile, very easily broke up. Their engines were unreliable, and crashes were common. And as we got a little bit into the war, still they were very fragile, and thousands of airmen died either in training accidents or because of engine failure or because the aircraft just broke up in the air.
So the attraction to join the Royal Army, I mean, obviously people wanted to do their bits in the First World War, and presumably, rather than becoming an officer and surgeon, you know, serving in the infantry, this is seen as cutting edge and for those of a more adventurous bent, shall we say, to get involved with the earliest flights.
Yeah, well, I think so. I mean, it was novel. They'd done it already. They'd been up in the air. I've even got a photograph that my great uncle took. It's a pretty indistinct one, but a photograph he took in 1913 some horses on the ground and taken from the air at a height of about 200 feet. So they were really interested in flying, they just, as people did in those days, they just got on with it, and that's they spent about 6 months training, and they got their aviator's certificate, which was the first bit of this, within a week. The sort of training and things that we do now and in the modern Air Force or anything which requires technical skills is far more complicated. Mm. They just did it, and they were flying on their own within days. Really scary.
Presumably,
this is
mainly, I mean, I know many of us may have seen Aces High, that brilliant film from the 70s, but presumably, yeah. Is it mainly reconnaissance he's doing, sort of low level stuff? Is he trying to spot sort of positions and movements behind enemy lines? And it's very low level flying, as we said. I mean, it's like 200, 300 feet above the ground. So it is extremely dangerous.
Well, it was actually, first of all, the initial value of the RFC was just as you say with reconnaissance. And in fact, it was much more effective. They used to use cavalry for reconnaissance because that was the thing that moved fastest. But aircraft outpaced them, and they just started to understand this before the beginning of the war with some exercises they did, that you could fly up in the air and watch troop movements. And there was a very famous occasion not long after the outbreak of war, when the Germans had made some really very deep advances and were doing very well, when a couple of aircraft observed that large numbers of German troops were moving across from east to west, just north of their lines, and they were going to make a big counterattack, which was supposed to be unexpected, in a completely different area of the lines. And they reported that back to the general in command, Sir John French, and that made the difference between German success and defeat, and probably actually stopped the Germans reaching Paris. So that was pretty significant. And then as reconnaissance carried on, so both sides tried to stop the others using their aircraft to do that. And so they started attacking them. And the squadron in which both my grandfather and my great uncle flew, 11th Squadron, was the first designated fighter squadron. And they had aircraft called a Vickers, FB5, a fighting biplane, five. And it weighed a ton. It had a top speed of about 70 miles an hour. And it took half an hour to climb to its operating height, which was about 9,000 feet. That's as long as it takes to get from, I don't know, Reading to Paddington, or for me, from Guildford to Waterloo. It was amazingly slow. With a little modern example, you talked about cutting edge technology. It was, but now the aircraft which 11 Fighter Squadron now operates is a Typhoon, and that weighs about 20 tons without its weaponry. So that's 20 times as much. It goes at about 1,500 miles an hour.
Right.
So that's more than 20 times as much. And I asked the pilot who was showing me around the aircraft, because I went to see the squadron, how long it took to get to 9,000 feet. And he looked at me as though I was mad and said, "Why do you want to know that?" So I told him, and he just smiled and said, "Seconds."
Yeah.
So that's modern cutting edge technology. And when we look at that old aircraft, we should remember that there's a replica of it in the Royal Air Force Museum in Hendon. We should remember that in its day, that was the cutting edge technology that was very successful. It was a very good and reliable aeroplane.
So where were they based? Was it movable? Because obviously they're not flying across the channel. It's not like a Second World War situation. I mean, they're obviously based a few miles back from the front, presumably, because they can't be.
They were. They had to fly across the channel, and that was quite exciting because that was a long way over the sea, and they didn't have life jackets in those days. They were actually given the inner tubes of car tires as their sort of life preservers and told to blow them up if they landed in the sea. But once they were over, that was fine. At least it was for most of the squadron. If you read the book, you'll find a funny story about the one who took rather longer to make it.
Right.
They were operating in bases just a few miles behind the lines. Before it stabilized, the front line moved back and forward. So sometimes they had to move from their bases in a hurry. But they were close, and occasionally they attacked each other's aerodromes. But by and large, most of the fighting took place in the air.
Did they? I mean, did your grandfather and your great uncle have the opportunity to go back and sample the lights of Paris as they were over in France? I mean, presumably they'd done that before having been to university. But it must have been it wasn't all if you like dangerous and hard work. There must have been some let off for them.
Yeah, they couldn't really go as far as Paris very often, although my great-grandfather was still living there because he was working as a dentist. That's how they'd... and that's why they were studying dentistry at the University of Paris, because they wanted to take over his practice and get rich. Well, the war soon put a stop to that plan. But they made the most of the opportunities, but there weren't very many. They were often having to fly such regular sorties and patrols that they didn't have the time for that. And incidentally, I might just mention one other thing about those early aircraft. The cockpits were open. They didn't even have windscreens to protect them. And the observer sat in the front with the gun, so the pilot was behind him. And the aircraft had the engine behind it, not at the front as we're used to with World War II aircraft. But up at 9,000 feet, it's very, very cold.
Yeah.
And they sometimes froze, literally. Would take, you know, they could practically not move for quite some time after they landed back on their bases, because they were so cold, and they had inadequate clothing, inadequate almost everything. We used to get up to 20,000 feet, where there was a real problem with a shortage of oxygen.
Yeah,
imagine how cold that must
have been. Because you need a pressurized cabin, anything sort of above that. But otherwise, as we see sort of later. I've often thought of the observers on the front with the engines behind the pilot, and there's the observer sort of basically half standing up with a machine gun. I mean, that is a job for total devil may care, if not crazy people, because it really, I mean, it really is. It's canvas and wood and a horse gun, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it was. And that, in the end, my grandfather trained as a pilot, but had a bad accident and served instead thereafter as an observer. And so he was the one in the front. He was doing that.
Chapeau, as the saying goes. Your great uncle wins a VC. Is this where he repairs his own plane under shell fire?
Yeah,
which,
that's right.
You know, so talk me through that one, because that, I mean, you're talking about the madness of courage. I mean, obviously the normal reaction was to find the nearest shell hole and stay there until the barrage is over.
Well, what had happened was he'd been involved in a dogfight with a German aircraft and had shot it down. But he went down to check that it was destroyed and came very low. It landed behind the German lines, had to come down very low. And in fact, it wasn't destroyed, and the crew were getting out of it, carrying the gun that from it, and saw Gilbert coming down, so turned around and started to fire at them. So Gilbert's observer, shot at them to discourage that, and they then came even lower and dropped a bomb on the aircraft to destroy it successfully. And then they were too low to be able to climb back to a safe height, and so crossed the lines at a very low altitude and were shot at. The petrol tank was holed. So the engine stopped. So he landed just behind the front, French front line and made a good landing without any power, got out of the aircraft, and the French took them down. You like this? Took them down into their dugout and gave them a large glass of red wine to restore them. This was first thing in the morning, so that's French panache and hospitality for you. And then after they'd sort of recovered their breath, because it had been very scary flying over the lines with everyone so low, with everyone shooting at them, he went out and examined the aircraft, saw what the problem was, called up the squadron, which was possible, and asked them to send another petrol tank and some engineers. And while this was going on, there was a German spotter plane acting to give directions to German artillery that was shelling them. And they fired about 150 shells in the course of the next 18 hours or however long it was. And he ignored that. They decided it would be better to do the repairs at night. And he supervised putting up some screens around the aircraft, and then moved it so the Germans didn't know where it was. He actually took part in and supervised the repair. And then at dawn the next morning, he got the French troops to fill in the shell holes and took off with a sandbag in the front seat, because he didn't want to risk the life of the observer. So he took off on his own. The Germans shot at him but missed, and he got home. So he was exposing himself both in the dogfight and by going down so low, risking his life there and risking his life to oversee the repair of his aircraft as well. But by the time the VC was announced, he'd been captured.
So he gets his luck runs out. I mean, but then again, you say his luck runs out, but they're incredibly lucky, I suppose, to actually sort of survive any situation. As we said before, flying is extremely dangerous. Full stop. Flying in the First World War is dangerous, and flying in the First World War, you know, under barrage, front lines getting popped out by the German lines as well. So how does he get shot down? And where does he end up?
Well, that was you're right. It was dangerous, and an awful lot of aircrew lost their lives from some very effective German fighter pilots like Manfred von Richthofen, but also because of the fragility of aircraft, which sometimes just broke up, or engine failure, or whatever. In his case, a month after he'd had the VC action, he was flying over the German lines again, involved in another dogfight with an aircraft, and he got another bullet through his petrol tank and was this time too far behind the lines to be able to get back, probably, though he started to make an attempt. And as he did, an anti-aircraft shell exploded just under his aircraft, and he got a large lump of shrapnel, about half a kilo, a pound in weight, hit him in his hip, in his buttock, and he lost consciousness for a bit, but managed to come to his senses again and to make a landing staggered out of the aircraft with his observer, tried to destroy it before the Germans came up, but didn't succeed, and then collapsed on the ground from his injury. And I've got a photograph. It's probably one of the most remarkable photographs of the Second World War, actually, in the book of him. It's a German photograph taken just after this had happened, when he's lying on a stretcher surrounded by Germans, being tended to by an orderly. And he looked at this man, and they recognized each other, because the orderly had been an opponent when they'd played hockey against each other in Hanover barely 18 months before.
Good grief.
So it's pretty unusual to meet someone whom you know on the opposite side on the battlefield. I don't know of it ever occurring again. And they weren't actually fighting, but they were opponents. But to meet again like that and to have a photograph of it is just extraordinary. Anyway, it's in the book if you want to see it, as well as a photograph of his aircraft.
The other thing is, of course, we haven't got the Geneva Convention at this point. So presumably, they are going under the shall we say the thing that they are knights of the air and the chivalry of. I mean, we can get all romantic, but I mean, the First World War was a horrendous conflict, we know, and if you're getting bombed or strafed by a Royal Air Corps thing, and your mates have been shot up, maybe you wouldn't be perhaps so. You wouldn't say, "Oh well done, Tommy," and you know we've got a warm fire for you. You might just sort of run them through, or just shoot them out of hand, or just bayonet them, wouldn't you? So he's got a bit of luck there as well.
Well, yeah, actually, there was chivalry for the most part. I mean, you tried to kill each other and you sometimes succeeded. But if your opponent crashed, you'd show them courtesy thereafter. And generally, you wouldn't attack them on the ground unless they were attacking you. It was really only when you got into prison camps that the treatment deteriorated, or on the way to prison camps, the prisoners were very badly treated. I might say before that happened, the German Air Force had a very good system of interrogating prisoners to get lots of information from them. They didn't do it with a formal interrogation. They actually would take them back to their messes and give them hospitality.
Right.
And look after them and have someone who was actually an intelligence officer sitting in on the conversation. And they didn't ask direct questions. There was just a chat for a day or two. Gilbert was interrogated. I've actually got from a German archive the records of the interrogations that took place, both of him and his observer. That's quite exciting because most of those were bombed by the RAF at the end of the Second World War. But happily, they missed this particular archive, and so I've got the record of what happened to him, which includes, incidentally, the curious little thing, the doctor who'd extracted the shrapnel from his buttock gave it to him as a souvenir. But the next day, lieutenant who was his sort of inquisitor, interrogator, wanted to find out what had happened to whether he had been shot down by the aircraft or shot down by anti-aircraft fire. And so he wanted the shrapnel to examine it to see where it had come from. So he only had that piece of shrapnel. It didn't stay with him thereafter. He lost it. So that's quite an interesting little story. And then they went on to prison camps. Life was much less friendly than the brief period they'd enjoyed in a German mess.
And he manages to escape. And if you think about it, we all know about the Second World War and escaping from the various camps behind the lines in Germany. But there was a very different atmosphere to that. And it wasn't like Operation to march people over the Pyrenees or anything like that. It was a very much sort of see if you can make it situation. I mean, your great uncle's family get involved, don't they, to help get him out, because he's one of the very few people to escape from a German camp.
There were 35 RFC officers. Just to give you I might mention this, there were about 650 VCs awarded during the First War, and 570 people succeeded in escaping, and Gilbert's the only one that fitted into both those categories.
Wow.
Most of them were ordinary ranks who were out on agricultural working parties and things, so they could get out. Officers were kept in camps, and it was much harder for them to do it. And yes, my family gave them a lot of help because there wasn't any official support until much later in the war, and they found ways of smuggling stuff into him. And he made three attempts. The first one was in a through a tunnel, which took 5 months to build, which was about 60 centimeters by 40 centimeters. Very, very small. 5 months. And airless and really unpleasant and difficult. And they had to get out in the middle of March, in the middle of winter from Heidelberg, because they'd got from a tame guard information that they were about to be moved to another camp. And they survived. They got a third of the way to Switzerland in thick snow and were picked up eventually on the point of exhaustion. And the second attempt was when they were about to be moved to another camp, and he got the orderlies that were arranging packages to put into storage for the prisoners, to leave a gap in the middle of it for him and somebody else to hide themselves while the carts containing the packages were driven out to the storage depot. And it was a very small space, and actually the other escapers had to kneel on Gilbert's head while they were going out. So that was pretty uncomfortable. And they couldn't find cover, so they were picked up quite quickly with that one. And the third one was from underneath. They dug under the floor of the bathhouse in Struan near Hanover, because they'd noticed that there was a little bit of a gap. They excavated it. There were about 40 of them in the shower room. There was a German sentry at the door. They dug a hole in the far corner, and the sentry didn't notice because there was so much movement going on. Okay. And five of them crawled into this hole in the middle of August, really hot, airless, and waited there throughout the day, because their bath time was early in the morning, until the middle of the following night, and then got out and walked for 9-10 days to get over to Holland.
I'm going to run out of time, unfortunately, because I could talk to you about this and probably until this time next week. The book is called The Madness of Courage. I exhort you to go and order it via our own virtual bookstore. What do you hope that people will discover from the book, Tony?
Well, first of all, how extraordinary were the lives that a lot of people lived in those days, and how the stubbornness, the madness of courage, actually, it was extraordinary. That's what people did in those days.
The book is called Madness of Courage. Tony, thank you so much for your time today.